Misfits, we're coming at you today with episode 20, our discussion episode of Yah Jessie's Homegoing. And I gotta be honest with you, this was almost the episode that never was. There were some technical difficulties, but we are cooking with fire now. So keep in mind, our discussion episodes are always loaded with spoilers. If you just want to get a sense of the book, go listen to episode 19. But if you're ready to dig in, let's get this party started. Hi, this is Maria Blackheart, and welcome to the Misfit Book Club, a podcast for readers, weirdos, blue stockings, normals, scribbling women, madmen, loons, screwballs, and every type of bookish person in between. This is episode 20, and I'm joined by my co-host, Pixie Burger.
Hey, go hey.
How are you, Pixie?
I miss you.
I miss you too. And we miss each other because we just saw each other.
Yes. It doesn't happen all the time, but it is so sweet when it does.
Yes. So our listeners might not realize this, but we live hundreds and hundreds of miles apart. Mm-hmm. And so once a year, we schedule a trip together. And we got back just like 2 weeks ago from Florida.
Yeah. It was so much fun. I wish it were twice as long as it had been. Maybe like 10 times longer. I mean, it was great.
We want to be on forever vacation together.
Yeah, it's something to work on. It's definitely a life goal, forever vacation. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how to make that happen.
Marry rich? I don't know. Isn't that like the crazy rich Asians?
Yes. Which, by the way, yeah, I'm dying to see Crazy Rich Asians. I cannot wait. It looks so good.
But anyway, our Florida trip was great. We spent time on the beach. We spent time by the pool. We went with a bunch of readers. So there were just hours of the day where we sat around and read books and didn't speak to each other. Mm-hmm. And it was wonderful.
I know. It's like the best vacation ever. And we went to bookstores and you saw some wildlife.
I did. I saw a manatee. I thought it was a shark. I was like, here it is. And then it came up and its little nose went... And it blew out little air, and I was like, no, I love it. And then, of course, I swam after it, which you're not supposed to do. But that little asshole was going fast, and I couldn't get a hold of him.
Well, I feel like that was just a special little gift just for you.
Oh, my God. We should probably also tell our listeners that I'm very enthusiastic about wildlife. Like, very enthusiastic.
Yep. Yep.
Not our last trip, but the trip before, I made Pixie swim with manatees.
Listen, it was one of the best things we've ever done. I honestly was like, eh, whatever. But then when we did it, it was fantastic and I'll never forget it.
Did any of them boop you out of the way?
Oh, totally got booped. Yeah, the way you swim with them is you just kind of like hover. You're not supposed mm-hmm. to try to scare them or like grab them or touch them or anything. They're not going to hurt you because they really can't. But it's just very respectful if you just let them boop you.
And they do.
It's so great.
Oh, they're so cute. This time we saw mermaids.
Yes, we did see mermaids, and we're not kidding. We went to Weekiwachee in Florida, which, honestly, when I found out about it, I thought it would be hilarious, and I wanted to go kind of as a joke, right? It just seemed so kitschy and hilarious, it was worth the time. So The trick was on me, though, because we got there, and we watched this mermaid show, and I was legit amazed.
I know, right?
Yes, these women were incredible, but they were, I mean... dancing in very cold and very, I would say, deep water, doing mm-hmm. all of these fantastic little swimmy moves without going to the surface, in full costume and in synchronization with music.
And with their eyes open. Like, they had their eyes open underwater. I couldn't do it.
No. I seriously left thinking that they were superheroes. The mermaids of Weekiwachee.
And they were gorgeous.
They were gorgeous and lovely.
If you get a chance... you should go.
So good.
It was great.
It was. So anyway, I miss you. I wish it were still happening, our friend vacation.
Me too. If you guys ever get a chance to travel with your best friends, do it. It's so fun. It's way better than traveling with your family.
Yeah, I gotta admit, it really is. It's so great. So now we're already planning our next one.
I'm still thinking Canada, Pixie.
I think Canada would be good because also that would be an escape plan for us. If shit goes south,
we'll go north.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it. So, yeah, we can move on to the book news.
Book news.
All right. I'm looking at our outline and Pixie has book news and then in parentheses, not really news. I love it. So there are a couple of like real short tidbits that I wanted to bring up because I know you've got a fun discussion, but yeah. A couple of just like points of interest for you guys who love fantasy. The Nebula Awards just happened and N.K. Jemisin just won for The Stone Sky. And so she is a Black author and she's written a trilogy. The Stone Sky is the final book and she just won, which I think is fantastic.
I've got to read her books. She was at a Book Riot event where I was and she was fantastic. And I've had some of her books on my iPad to read and just haven't done it.
Okay, well, let's add them in 2019.
I might do it, yeah.
Okay, I've got two more tidbits. Mm-hmm. I'm going to start with this one. So in film adaptation news this week, Nello Larsen's Passing, which is one of my all-time favorite books, is being adapted, starring Ruth Negga mm-hmm. and Tessa Thompson. So yeah. I cannot wait. And the book is about two friends, one of whom is able to pass for white. And this is, of course, like pre-civil rights movement. And the book is short, but phenomenal.
It's so good. And it's extremely depressing.
Yes and yes.
But it's really good.
And my last tidbit made me laugh so hard I cried. So, okay. Rodale Press published a cookbook by an influencer and her name is Johanna Holmgren and her whole shtick is like foraging for food, which what the hell, right? Like, let's just start there. Like, girl, what the hell? Why forage for food if you don't have to? Like, this feels like a super like hipstery thing to do, right?
I know what you want to say. You want to say that seems like a stupid white person trick.
And it does.
I'll just say it for you. That's what it is.
So anyway, she got this book deal and she wrote this cookbook called Tales from a Forager's Kitchen with like all of these tips for foraging and like all of these recipes for food you can make from your foraged items. And a bunch of people wrote into the press and were like, hey, these recipes are poison. Like, you can't eat this stuff. If you do, you're going to get very, very sick. And they pulled it from the shelf. You can no longer buy Tales from a Forager's Kitchen because it will kill you.
I love this story so much. As soon as I saw it, I also started cackling because I feel like lifestyle blogging, for one, is such bullshit. Like, just the premise of it is so irritating to me. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to get on Instagram and I'm going to take a bunch of pictures of my picture perfect life and make it look like it's not staged at all. And then sell everybody a whole bunch of products under the premise that their, you know, life is going to be easier if they buy more stuff, even mm-hmm. though my premise may be simplicity or foraging or blah, blah. Like, it's just so fucking stupid. I'm sorry. Yes. And it makes me so mad. So just the fact that they published this person's book, and I'm presuming she was like foraging mushrooms or something, which is extremely dangerous. Hello. Don't be stupid, people. Like, if you're going to forage for food, at least forage through the dumpster of a restaurant that has probably properly cooked the food.
Like, what the hell? Listen, if you can't go to Whole Foods and buy it, because we all know that Whole Foods is full of weird shit, don't go into the wild and get it.
No, like, this is just some hipster's gimmick gone awry and everybody gets what they deserve. The end.
And therein are my three tidbits, but I just died with that last one.
I love it. Oh, man. So my only contribution was that I got on Book Reddit, which I do occasionally, but mm-hmm. I found this Reddit question and I kind of got obsessed with it. So I'm just going to read it.
Yeah, go.
I just mm-hmm. finished Cat's Cradle by Vonnegut and loved it. But I knew that if I'd read it when I was in high school, it would have become my absolute favorite book as it had everything I needed to hear at the time. Same with Something This Wicked This Way Comes. I read it during summer break in college for a break from serious reading and enjoyed it, but wish I'd read it in elementary school. Any books you've read that you wish you'd found at a different time in your life?
Oh, that's a great question.
I thought it was really good. And it got me to thinking about some books that I wish I'd read at different times.
Okay.
And also books that I'm kind of afraid to visit because I feel like this is the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I think somebody else, I came across a similar question on Reddit then, where they were like, I'm afraid to reread my favorite books in case they don't hold up.
Yeah, I've thought that a lot, actually. There are books that I did not read when I was young and then have subsequently avoided as an adult because mm-hmm. I don't feel like it'll have like the same resonance for me. So a good example, I think, would be like I haven't read Catch 22.
Oh, my gosh.
One of those books.
I haven't either.
Are you serious? I was almost afraid to say that out loud.
Maybe we need to read that for this podcast.
Okay. All right. We can add Catch 22 to the list. I have not read Slaughterhouse-Five
mm-hmm.
for the same reason.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just feel like I wouldn't get as much out of it as an adult. Yeah. Like those are my two big ones that like everybody's read.
So I think my best example is actually The Handmaid's Tale because that one mm-hmm. I did read in high school and I didn't really get it or care for it. And I remember yeah. having this reaction. And we talked about this in the episodes that like I didn't think it was feasible at all or that that sort of world would be something that I would ever see. But coming back around and reading it in 2017, I have very different thoughts and feel like it's yeah. much more timely and terrifying to me now than it was 15 to 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I've got an example. I read Great Expectations in high school and hated it. Like, I didn't understand it. I thought it was hard to read. And then I read it in one of my undergrad classes. And I remember walking up to my professor after the first discussion day. And I was like, why didn't anybody tell me this was great? And that actually, it put me into 19th century lit for sure.
Yeah.
If I had not read Great Expectations at that time with that particular professor, I may have done an entirely different type of literature
wow.
for my research.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just like the right thing at the right time. So what a good question. Let's toss that to our listeners. And I'll try to remember to do that as a social media question too. Are there any books that you guys have read that you wish that you'd found at a different time?
I'm still thinking about it, to be honest. Like, I think this person is wondering if she could go back in time and give herself a book. What would she give herself? Which I don't have an answer for that yet, but I'm going to. I'm still thinking about it.
What a good question. I think we should mull it over a little more and then we can come back to it.
I'll send out a tweet with the link to Reddit so that I can credit the person who came up with it.
We don't plagiarize here.
No, we do not.
All right. Well, that's the book news. We actually had quite a bit of it, I think. And so speaking of important representation in literature, I think Homegoing is a really great book to kind of couple with that thought.
For sure. Right?
Homegoing by Yaa Jessie is our read for this month. If you don't want to be spoiled, like this is a good place to stop. But our previous episode contains no spoilers, so go listen to that. But yeah, Homegoing is a multi-generational tale. It goes from parent to child, and the child has a child and then tells the story of that child, so forth and so on, through basically an African family. And at some point, the family tree splits and part of the family stays in Africa and part of the family goes to the United States. So it's a very generational, intergenerational epic. So what did you think?
Okay. I liked it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many cool things about this book. I liked the premise of it, that mm-hmm. we have these two sisters, I guess, who are separated. And then we get the ancestral details of the generations that come after them. Is that mm-hmm. how I would say it?
Yeah.
Anyway, and see how these two branches of the family tree have different sorts of lives. Basically, one of the sisters is sold into slavery and the other is not. So we get to kind of see that going back and forth. And I've never read anything exactly like this, mm-mm. which is a lot to say, considering we read a lot, but also that Yaa Jessie is such a young person and had such a cool creative idea for a book. I'm just kind of blown away by that.
Yeah, I think I would totally echo those sentiments. I thought the structure was incredibly unique. This is one of those books where I read and it's kind of floated around in the back of my mind in weird ways since I finished it. And one of the things that I keep thinking about is how many of our ancestors that we know nothing about, even if you spit in a cup and like get your 23andMe or do your Ancestry.com or whatever, you can't ever really know those people, right? Their stories die out. And yet, well, you can see in Homegoing how the choices that people made decades and decades and centuries before are critical to where you have ended up.
Yeah.
That's not really a way that I have thought about legacy before. I often think about legacy in a forward-looking way, right? Like, what kind of legacy do I want to leave? What mark do I want to leave? But I don't think about the way that legacy looks backwards very often. That's made me think about, you know, the course of my life in a different way.
Yeah, for sure. So one person that I think is the queen of the internet is Roxane Gay.
Mm-hmm.
And she reads books and reviews them on Goodreads. So if you don't follow her on Goodreads, go do it right now because she writes really good reviews, I think. So something she wrote about this book really, really resonated with me. She says, Homegoing is a very confident debut novel, exceptionally engaging and the strongest case for reparations and black rage I've read in a long time. Seriously, white men are the devil. Which that is another thing about Roxane is she does not hold back. She says what she believes in terms of how much people are pissing her off from day to day. So she gave Homegoing 4 stars, which is pretty good.
I think so.
But I'd never read a book that took this on in such a literal way. And I think she's right that it shows us that wealth, that success, that so many things that a lot of people like to believe about themselves or self-made are actually part of a long system of people.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? I don't know.
Yeah. The idea of being self-made is...
Yeah, it's a myth. People like to believe that everything that they have is because they worked really hard or that they deserve it, when in reality, so many of the circumstances in every person's lives are inherited.
Yeah, and that actually made me start thinking about the way that we inherit trauma specifically. So the thing with Homegoing is the book starts off just horrifically with someone being sold into slavery. Right. Mm-hmm. And the picture that, yeah, Jesse paints is terrifying. It is sickening. It is horrifying. Like, it's all of those things. And that is real trauma.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we can all say, like, yes, being sold into slavery is traumatic, Maria. Like, come on. Let's not be stupid here.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing that psychologists have found is that that level of trauma can be inherited. So what that means is, like, that trauma gets passed down from generation to generation to generation for a long, long time. And so I actually found a quote. This is called Transgenerational Trauma, and it is by a man named Mark Wolin. And he writes, quote, many of us walk around with trauma symptoms we can't explain. Whether it's sudden onset or chronic, we have anxieties, depressions, or obsessive thoughts we've never gotten to the bottom of. We never think to connect our personal issue to what's happened to our parents or grandparents. But we're now learning that traumas experienced by previous generations can be biologically inherited, and I think that's surprising for many people. The good news is that once we make these links, we can then break the cycle. The bad news is, if we don't make the links, we move forward with something we never quite get to the source of.
That's really fascinating. Yeah.
The idea that there's a biological component is controversial. So some people are like, yeah, of course, like, trauma alters your DNA and then that passes on to your children. Some people think that that's a little bit of a stretch. But what everybody agrees on is that from a parenting standpoint, trauma changes the way that you will raise your child. So, I don't know, this is kind of a sad story, but I'll tell it anyway. My husband's company partners really closely with the local children's shelter. And my husband is a photographer, And one of the things he does is he will go to the children's shelter and take pictures at events with the kids, but for fundraising materials. Right. And one of the things that the shelter does is they have classes for parents who've lost their kids to the system. They have to teach parents to feed their kids because the parents grew up hungry, because their parents grew up hungry, because their parents grew up hungry. So they don't feed their children, or they don't hold their children. They'll leave their children in cribs for like 6 or 7 hours at a time with no human contact because they were not held and touched as children. Mm. And all of those are traumas, right? All of those are abuses that you internalize in a way that passes on behaviorally. So not just epigenetically, right? Mm-hmm. Not just through your DNA, but through your behavior patterns. And so I think I buy that a little more as an argument. But homegoing is really interesting because it takes this idea of transgenerational trauma, right? Being sold into slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it shows you how that totally changes the lineage of this family for like 8, 9, 10 generations. It just echoes through to modern day to the point where the characters in the modern day don't think about it. But you can see as a reader how their great, great, great grandmother being sold into slavery has totally changed where they are today.
Right. And one of the things this book does is talk about how certain Africans were also complicit in the slave trade, mm-hmm. which not a lot of people talk about that. And in fact, one of the sisters marries a white man who is a slave trader. That's kind of how that happens. And so she is absolutely complicit in a way because she's living off of all of the money that her husband makes selling people. So there's a chapter later on in that family tree's thread where one of the mothers is speaking to her son, and I've got a quote from it. And she says, "There is evil in our lineage. There are people who have done wrong because they could not see the result of the wrong. They did not have these burned hands as warning. Evil begets evil. It grows, it transmutes so that you cannot see that the evil in the world began in your own home." So this woman who is sort of seen as a, I think they call her the mad woman of this town, is able to see that there is something very toxic. There's poison in her family line, and it comes dozens of years back from this sin of slavery.
Yeah.
And that's a fairly, that's like even a very biblical idea, right? Like the fact that the son pays for the sins of the father is a fairly common religious doctrine, I would say, that you can't run away from the stuff that has happened before you.
Yeah, that nothing exists in a vacuum.
No.
And so that's actually one of the questions that we asked on our social media was, how have your ancestors impacted where you are today? And so I screw this up every time because I don't speak French. Sorry. But at C'est la vie dans les livres? Ooh, that's not right. But you know,
yes.
We'll tag you. She wrote, "This is a hard question because we are our ancestors' product." She said that she did a DNA ancestry test and it showed that her heritage came from 2/3 of the world. So who knows how each ancestor came about? Was it through love or rape or war? I think the most important thing is that without those decisions, I wouldn't exist. Being alive is an accident that I'm appreciating more as I'm getting older. So I thought that was a really insightful comment, right? The idea that we are part of a larger story connected by these invisible threads that we don't even really see.
Yeah, for sure. Karen B., who is at Cosmic Florabella, says, "My paternal grandparents were Jews that immigrated from Eastern Europe right before World War II. Thankfully, they did so, because if they hadn't, there is a decent chance that my father would not have been born or would have been born in Auschwitz. My grandparents both grew up near Auschwitz," which is amazing to even think about, really.
When I read that, I got goosebumps.
Yeah.
Like, it's one of those stories where you can see in a moment how your life could have been totally different or not existed, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I just think it's really cool to look back and see how choices of people you know, mm-hmm. your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents, have totally changed where you are today.
Absolutely. And I actually really am into that sort of story. I will just say, on my Strengths Finders test, one of my strengths is connectedness. So it's a thing that
I see that.
Yeah, it's just a thing that I can't not see is that everything a person does has so many effects to the extent that they have no idea what they are. Sort of like the butterfly effect times Brazilian. So, yeah. You know, that's just kind of how I see the world. So that is the thing that I really liked about this book is that it demonstrates that writ large, that this one thing that happened has changed the course of history. It's fun. It's a fun experiment to think about how, you know, maybe one shift might have altered that course. Of course, we can't go back and do that. We can't go back and see what it would have been. But I love the vision that Yaw Jesse has created here by being able to take us back in time and show us how a few choices made huge outcomes for this family.
And can I just say, just on a personal note, that your ability to see the connectedness of all things is one of the things I like most about you. I think it's a really rare talent, and I think it makes you a very good person.
Oh, shucks, Maria. I think there's a lot of value to that strength. It's better than some of the other ones.
Oh, my God. I don't even want to talk about my strengths finder because it's kind of embarrassing how not positive it is. So legacy is a big theme of the book, but in a lot of ways, the legacy part of it can also be Homegoing's biggest flaw.
Yes. And this was something I was feeling a little bit guilty about while I was reading the book. I guess I hate critiquing certain books, you know, because I feel like the art was so good and the gimmick was really good and that you follow these two different family lines. But basically, all of the chapters are, would you say, like 20 to 30 pages tops?
At the most.
And so you get to know a character a very small amount. And then you move on to the next character. And so it's kind of hard to get super invested in anybody individually because occasionally you're lucky and the ancestor bleeds over into the next chapter where they're that central character's parent. But that doesn't always happen. So I felt like even though that was really clever and that is one of the things that made the book really interesting and different, it also made it a little bit less emotionally engaging.
Yeah. As I was reading through, I had this weird thought, you know, is this a novel or is this a collection of short stories where the common theme is the shared family history? Because a lot of times it really reads like a collection of short stories. I feel like I could take a chapter out of the book and give it to somebody to read, and they could still read it and enjoy it, even if they wouldn't have like the rest of the context for it. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. Yeah. And I hadn't thought of it that way, actually. But you totally could pull one chapter out and say, give it to your students to read for a lit class.
Yeah. And so the shifting points of view make it hard to really connect to characters sometimes, because if there isn't something that resonates with you right away, there's not enough time for you to build a connection, right?
Yes.
And I guess families are kind of like that, too, if we're being honest. There are family members that you just, you know, jive with, and other family members that you love, but it's harder to get along with them.
Right. And I was feeling a little bit validated about that opinion when I pulled up Roxane Gay's review of Homegoing. And she adored the book and rated it very highly, too. But let me read just this little section from her review. And if you guys don't follow Roxane Gay on Goodreads, you absolutely should, because her book reviews are great.
They're so funny.
She doesn't hold back her feelings at all, generally. But that's part of why I love her. Okay, she says, the closer we get to present day, the more the chapters feel like they are designed, not so much as fictional narratives, but rather as vignettes meant to reveal specific historical moments and sociopolitical ideas. The Civil War, the end of slavery, the Great Migration, modern civil rights. Which aside, that is true. It's very epic in that sense. And then she continues, the chapters become shorter. We have less time to feel connected to the characters, and the narrative starts to feel less satisfying. And then there is the ending, which is necessary for what the writer is trying to do, but which also feels terribly convenient and insubstantial. So she gave it 4 out of 5 stars, which is a good rating.
Yeah.
But I totally agree. The shorter the chapters got, the less invested we were in the people, and the very thing that made it a unique book kind of, I wouldn't say backfired in that way, but it made it much harder to get attached.
I agree. And so we asked all of you guys how you feel about books with multiple points of view. And you guys had so many opinions, like a million opinions. Like there are so many responses that we cannot include them all or we would be here all night.
So you did a poll, right? That asked people how, if they liked different points of view in books, and what did you find?
Yeah, so on our Insta stories, we found that 83% of you like different points of view in your books. But in our Instagram conversation, you all had some caveats to that. So, for example, Megs at Megs Wonderland, April at Newell Novels, at We Three Readers, and Haley at Tale of a Bibliophile all said they love it if it's done well. So Meg specifically recommended the Bennett Family series and the Connor Family series by Layla Hagen as examples of romance novels where alternating points of view work really, really well.
I definitely like a romance novel with multiple points of view.
Right?
When you get the man's take and the woman's take, or the woman's take and the woman's take, or the man's take and the man's take. I like that.
That's really cool.
It is cool. The Orphan's Code says, it depends on how it's done. I think it adds a depth to a story that no single narrator ever could. Authors that stick to one POV have to do all kinds of somersaults to get certain information across. For example, Harry Potter has the newspaper, gossiping students, or sometimes even a chapter told from a third-person point of view when Harry isn't around. And then she recommends the Wheel of Time series by Robert Jordan and his Dark Material series by Philip Pullman, neither of which I have read.
Me either. So the Robert Jordan series is so long that I will probably never read it.
Same. We have one mutual friend who is obsessed with that series.
We do?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I also have not read either of those. Okay, I am getting texts, but I can't tell. I have a new iPad and I don't know how to work it because I'm old. God damn it.
Sometimes my iPad just goes blaring in the office. It's so embarrassing. And I'm like, oh, shit.
Anyway, where are we? I feel a little guilty for not having read the Philip Pullman books, I guess, but I'm definitely interested in reading them because the BBC is currently filming a series.
Of his Dark Materials?
Yes. Ooh. And Lin-Manuel Miranda's in it.
Oh, well, sign me up there. Hello.
Right?
I had a copy of the series and it just mysteriously walked away. Someone borrowed it and never gave it back.
Oh.
Virginia Foote says, I have actually ended up loving multiple narrators, except when they end up writing the same exact chapter in different POV. Some of my favorite books have had different POV, but where the first half of the novel is in one character and then it changes to another.
And Tanya at Motifink says, it really depends on how strong the author made the narrators. Sometimes two voices work out well while only one works. So it's really hit or miss. And I totally agree with that. My biggest complaint is when both voices sound the same.
Yes, I can't stand that.
If I can't immediately tell it's the other character, then something's not working out.
Well, what was the point in that case, really? I mean, I guess it's convenient from a plot standpoint, like to get certain information across, but it takes skill to create different voices.
And I think a lot of people choose the easy route. Like, they're like, oh, it's going to be so much easier to plot my book if I can give you both sides of the war or both sides of this issue. But a lot of authors lack the skill to create two completely different voices and have them be consistent. And finally, Blue at Writer's Review says, honestly, I think it depends on the skill of the author. Sometimes it's great, but just as often the voices are inconsistent or there's one strong narrator while the others seem like afterthoughts. Which, Blue, you read our minds.
The thing that this book does that is really special is that it manages to take this one family line and turn it into an epic. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the point of view switches was necessary. I mean, that was the entire point of the story, really, was to show how this curse travels down through the family. The way that she gets around that, though, is we have this kind of omniscient narrator who tells the story. And so I think that was a wise decision. It would have been, I don't think I would have liked it as much if it had been, you know, first person from person to person to person, because this omniscient narrator could draw the thread out.
Yes, you're exactly right. Interestingly enough, like, you have this omniscient narrator who tells all these stories from, I guess, what we would call a limited third person point of view. Mm-hmm. So when you get into the story, you're only seeing the story, the narrator attaching to one character. So whoever the title character is, that's the person whose thoughts and feelings you get. So I had called it multiple points of view, but I think you bring up a really good point that the book is actually told from one point of view, this narrator that we don't know, and the chapters all give us different perspectives.
I think so. And now that I'm trying to remember it specifically, it may have been closer to just a straight omniscient narrator. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. It's been a couple of weeks since we read this book. So I feel like maybe the narrator did drop into some other heads too, not just the character that the godlike narrator was focusing on. I couldn't tell you. But those are two separate things.
This is a very, like, book nerdy conversation to have, but that's also why we do this podcast. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we talk about Real Housewives, and sometimes we get into the weeds. And that's what's kind of cool about this conversation, is it really is kind of hard to put your finger on exactly what technique this book is using. And that's what makes it really unique, mm-hmm. in my perspective. Now, usually you open a book and you know exactly what's happening. Okay, I've got a first person. It uses I, me, my, we, our, right? Very mm-hmm. clearly, this is our narrator. I have a third person narrator with a limited point of view, and that point of view is limited to my hero or heroine. The Hate U Give is written in third person limited. Okay. Third person omniscient is when the narrator is basically God and can tell you what everybody's doing and everybody's thinking at any given moment. And so mm-hmm. Jurassic Park is third person omniscient.
That one's actually really hard to do because the transitions need to be smooth and they're harder to achieve because you're going from a whole, from one head to another, basically. And yes. You're dropping in on these different minds. And sometimes that can feel very jarring if it's not done well.
I think so.
There are so many different ways to tell a story.
Which is so great, right?
Yeah.
We didn't even talk about second person, which is a choose your own adventure book. So, which I would love to read for this podcast. I've got to be totally honest.
That's not a bad idea. Let's kind of file that one away for later.
You come here for the jokes, but you stay for the stuff you need to write your college papers. Okay, so this is the part of the podcast where we say, if you liked Homegoing, you should read this. And so I have a couple of recommendations. My first recommendation is Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America by Ibram X. Kendi. So this is a nonfiction book. It won the National Book Award last year, year before last. I can't remember. And it basically looks at the ways that slavery has impacted every facet of American life. Is this going to be a book that you read and leave, put it down, and then you feel warm and fuzzy inside when you're done? No. But are you going to start to see the ways that one particular historical system has changed the entire way that the United States lives today? Yes. And I think it's an important book, if only for that reason. So I recommend that. My second recommendation is The Conjure Woman by Charles W. Chestnut. And this one is old. So it was written in 1899 and then collected in 1993. And Charles Chestnut was an African-American man, a short story writer, and a political activist. And so this book is a lot like Homegoing in that they're all separate stories. So every chapter well, it's not even chapter, it's a collection of short stories, right? So every short story is told by one narrator named Uncle Julius, but the short stories follow the lives of many characters who overlap in different ways. Also, this book was really important when it came out because it tackled a lot of stereotypes about slaves in a way that really hadn't been seen before. So not only was this an African-American writer who was writing short stories that people were reading, it was basically celebrating the African-American folklore tradition in a really important way. So I definitely recommend that book. My third recommendation is The Golden Apples by Eudora Welty. And I would bet dollars to donuts that Jesse has read The Golden Apples because it's very similar to Homegoing in that it is set in one small southern town and each chapter follows a different townsperson. Mm. And all the stories kind of overlap in and out of one another. And it also has the motif of fire. So a motif is just a symbol that recurs over and over and over throughout a book. So Homegoing, fire is absolutely a motif. People catch on fire, shit burns down, there's fire everywhere. In The Golden Apples, the motif of fire comes from this phrase that is used over and over called a fire in the head. And that's people who are different. Right? Who think differently, who envision a different life for themselves than they can find in this small southern town. So The Golden Apples is very short. It is excellent. And I recommend it as well.
You said it's short stories?
A novel. It's okay. Like, it's almost exactly like Homegoing in that it is a novel, mm-hmm. but each chapter follows a different character.
Okay. I do not think I've read Golden Apples. I think I would remember it if I had.
Welty's great, though.
Oh, she's wonderful. Add that one to my TBR. All right. My list is short. The first pick that I've got is Kindred by Octavia Butler, which is a bit of a classic in its own right. It is a time-traveling slave narrative.
Hmm.
So a lot of people categorize it as science fiction. And Octavia Butler, a lot of people, if you're asking them, please name me a science fiction writer who is black, she's the only one that they can come up with, which is sad. But she was prolific, and this book is fantastic, very entertaining, thought-provoking, and there's one scene with an arm that you will never forget if you read it.
I haven't read it, but I really want to because I love Butler.
Yeah, it's super good. And then my second pick is The Known World by Edward P. Jones, which is a pretty famous award-winning novel. I think it won a Pulitzer, maybe. It is also a historical novel. And like Homegoing, The Known World takes on the very complicated issue of black people owning slaves. He does it very deftly and artfully. So that's a subject a lot of people don't know much about. And I did not know anything about it until I read that book. So,
and I will admit a lot of ignorance about that topic.
Same. But The Known World is a very beautiful and hard novel. So I recommend it.
So I just have to admit, this is one of my favorite segments of our podcast because, one, I am reminded that we are both big readers, but we've read such different things.
Mm-hmm.
But two, it always adds to my TBR.
I know. If only we could live forever so that we could read all the books.
Honestly, if I had a superpower, this is true. Mm-hmm. So whenever anybody's like, if you could have any superpower, what superpower would you want? And all you other basics are like, invisibility. I have two that I go to. One is I want to be able to touch a picture of food and it just magically appear and I don't have to cook it.
Mm.
Like I just open my Cooking Light magazine and I just boop, tap a picture of like a Thanksgiving spread and it just shows up on my table. That's the best superpower.
The magical food boop.
Yes. My second go-to superpower is to be able to touch a book and have instantly read it.
Instant osmosis.
Yes. Or maybe that's just generally what I want is osmosis. But anyway, those are my two go-to superpowers.
I would like to think about exercising and my body actually be exercising, though it's not exercising.
Girl.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Why we live in 2018 and I cannot go to bed at night and hook myself up to some machine that exercises me all night.
Yes.
Why does this not exist?
If our bodies and minds could be completely asleep but exercising all night long, that would be the revolution of invention.
I would honestly sell my husband for that machine.
I'm telling him you said that. And I always love hearing your picks, Maria. So.
Aw, thank you. I appreciate that.
Speaking of picks.
Do you want to tell them or do you want me to?
I mean, I feel like maybe I should tell them because I sort of picked it.
You did.
Okay. Guys, our next read is going to be The Valley of the Dolls by Jacqueline Suzanne. We're taking a step back in time a little bit. Do you want to read the summary for everybody?
I will. Dolls. Red or black, capsules or tablets, washed down with vodka or swallowed straight. For Anne, Neely, and Jennifer, it doesn't matter as long as the pill bottle is within easy reach. These three women become best friends when they are young and struggling in New York City and then climb to the top of the entertainment industry, only to find there is no place left to go but down into the Valley of the Dolls.
You read that so beautifully.
I'm so excited to do this book.
So can I tell you why I sort of wanted to read this book?
Yeah.
So I had been wanting to read it for some time, and one of our good friends read it, which maybe we'll get her to add a comment to the next episode. I don't know. Maybe.
I think we could. I think I could make that happen.
We might be able to get her to record a word or two in favor of the Valley of the Dolls. But I had also come across this article a couple of years ago in LitHub called the article is called In Defense of Trash. If anybody loves a trashy book, it's me or you. Anyway, I won't read this whole article, but I will read a paragraph.
Okay.
And the writer, her name is Lisa Levy.
Okay.
She says, yes, I am a proud reader of trash. Though having said that, I argue that the term not be redeemed or taken back, but removed from circulation when it comes to discussions of literature. Clement Greenberg could redeem kitsch, and Susan Sontag gave us the gift of camp. But to call books trash is to equate them with garbage, which these books are patently not. They are funny, sexy, entertaining takes on contemporary society. Do they exaggerate? Yes, but so does a lot of fiction, from Jonathan Swift onwards. Are they raunchy? Sure, but so is James Joyce. Why do they get treated so poorly? I suspect it's because they are written by women for women, and women's pleasures are often placed in the guilty category, both by women and men alike. Women apologize for reading these books the same way they will for seeing a rom-com or eating something with calories or, God forbid, spending time with friends instead of their families. In other words, we apologize for doing what we like to do rather than what we should, which is preposterous. When is the last time a man apologized for playing golf or watching sports or reading Maxim or grabbing a beer with his friends? They don't.
Amen.
So anyway, this article talks about books like Valley of the Dolls. Valley of the Dolls is sort of the cover image, and how books like this have gotten a bad rap, and other sorts of women's entertainment forever, basically, has gotten a bad rap for being quote unquote trashy, when really, is that true?
I can't wait to talk about this.
Yes. So anyway, that was sort of my frame of mind when I picked it, as someone who loves high literature and quote unquote trashy television and books.
Mm-hmm. Just an aside on James Joyce. Mm-hmm. I'm like 90% sure he was super into his wife's farts.
I mean, talk about raunchy.
Right?
Yes.
I think I recollect his like love letters to his wife specifically referencing that particular fetish.
People have their predilections, okay? We let them have them.
And I think, like, people are much less likely to call a book written by a man trash. If we're going to call anything trash, like create a trash can of literature or whatever, I would put, like, the Clive Cussler books in there. They absolutely fit the same definitions of quote-unquote trash. They're the same plot over and over and over. Like, that's what people accuse romance novels of being, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
Only no one is going to look you in the eye and be like, that Clive Cussler, that's trash. Zane Grey, Louis L'Amour.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all what we would call canonical authors.
Yep.
They are taught in college classrooms and they do the same thing.
Anything that's formulaic by women gets treated much more poorly than formulaic books written by men.
Exactly. And the really cool thing about Jacqueline Suzanne, and we'll get into this next episode, the writer of Valley of the Dolls, is she was the first author ever to have three consecutive books hit number one on the New York Times bestseller list.
See? Mm-hmm. This is the thing. This is a pattern. When women succeed, when they do really well, when they make a lot of money, people call their stuff trash. It happens all the time.
And so with that, we have jumped the rails, which we do at the end of every episode.
Yes, we do.
And so that's how you know that we're about to wrap things up. So make sure you tell people about us. If you have enjoyed the episodes that we've done, if you like us in your earballs, we can't spread the word the way a lot of people do because we are anonymous. So if you like what you hear, tell someone about us. Word of mouth is the way that we get new listeners.
We would also love it if you would subscribe to the podcast or give us a quick little rating or review. You can find us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, or TuneIn Radio.
And we haven't mentioned this in a long time, but you can also stream all of our episodes directly from our website, misfitbookclub.com.
That's right.
Also, all of our conversations happen on social media because we are addicted in unhealthy ways. So make sure to follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Misfit Book Club. On Goodreads, you can type in our email address and be our friends. And our email is misfitbookclubpodcast@gmail.com. So if you have any podcast suggestions, if there are books you want to read, if there are things you want to see us do with our podcast that we haven't done yet, email us. We want to hear from you.
We do, when we are very open-minded people.
I mean, Pixie's very open-minded. I don't know that I would go so far as to say that about myself.
You are, Maria. Well, thanks, guys, for listening.
Thank you, guys. We'll see you later.
Bye.
Bye.